Today, is Donald Trump using racism to stay in the White House? And Julian Borger on Iran, America, and the capture of a British-flagged oil tanker. This week, Donald Trump intensified his attacks on the Democrats, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Presley, by saying that he believed they were not capable of loving America. On Twitter, of course, he doubled down on earlier hugely controversial and racist comments.
The original tweets were Donald Trump saying that these four progressive Democratic congresswomen should go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came.
And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave. They can leave, and you know what? I'm sure that there'll be many people that won't miss them.
The reality is that three of the four women are American citizens who were born here, and one was naturalized here as a child.
Men like him have been telling women like me to go back to my own country for a long time.
We all know the recent tweets and words from the president are simply a continuation of his racist and xenophobic playbook.
He would love nothing more than to divide our country.
I encourage the American people and all of us in this room and beyond to not take the bait.
But while the Democrats voted to condemn the remarks as racist in the House of Representatives, many Republicans remained silent or even chose to defend the president. And then there was this strange response to journalists from key advisor Kellyanne Conway.
To which countries was he referring?
What's your ethnicity?
Why is that relevant?
No, because I'm asking you a question. My ancestors are from Ireland and Italy.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, is Trump using racism to try to win the 2020 election? When I heard supporters at a huge Trump rally break out into a chant of send her back after he mentioned the Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, I found it chilling. Was that your reaction?
Absolutely. I think it's hard to have any other reaction.
Jamiles Latte is a reporter at Guardian US.
To have that sort of occur in that very organic environment and to have the president sort of soaking up that kind of almost, I mean, it's almost like a professional wrestling kind of moment of, you know, the crowd egging on the heel and the president kind of soaking it up as the valiant hero. That really damages their messaging that this is about anything other than racist feelings towards a woman of color and a congresswoman.
You know, I feel this personally here when people talk about it. It is the kind of oldest racist trope that is said to second generation immigrants of color. Go home where? But overall in America, the debate is presumably playing out about whether this is racism or not. And a lot of people don't think it is. What do they think it is?
For my money, most of these sort of arguments that this isn't racism are just being made sort of from the political standpoint that being a racist or having racist ideas is one of the worst things that you can do. And it would be politically sort of untenable to admit that that's what this is. So you've got to find some other explanation.
Is this a tactical political move? Or does he really believe it?
The question is Trump sort of this master manipulator, you know, who knows exactly what strings he's pulling, just this kind of Svengali puppet master who's just sort of just working the levers of American racism to his benefit? Or is he just this kind of garden variety narcissist bigot whose self-serving utterances just kind of happen to fit like a perfect puzzle piece as a catalyst of all these kind of latent threads of racism in American society? And like, I'll leave that question to others to decide, but you know, the sort of bare fact of it is that it has been effective to this point. That's why he's president, and it remains effective.
Do you think he might be trying to set a trap for the Democrats?
maybe it kind of works for him. I mean, he's forcing the Democratic Party to bring these women in. They are, as a like just as a matter of fact, on the left flank of the party. They're out of agreement with the majority of the party in terms of, you know, the actual legislators in Congress on a number of issues. So, I mean, it would give Trump, you know, the ability to say they're all Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The Democrats are all Ayanna Pressley. They're all Rashida Tlaib. They're all Ilhan Omar. And that would be a really powerful tool in the 2020 election, especially if the Democrats end up nominating someone like Joe Biden, who is going to want to run sort of to the center and be able to kind of speak to moderate blue collar white Democrats in Rust Belt states.
Regardless of who will win, we know Trump attracts the support of tens of millions of people. Is any of that because of the racism, or is it in spite of it?
There is a faction of folks who, and we've seen it in sort of kind of ethnography after ethnography of Trump voters. There is a faction who don't like that he's on Twitter. They don't like that he calls people names. They don't like the types of language he uses, but they basically support him and his policy ideas. And then there is the faction of folks who are completely enthusiastic about this aspect of Donald Trump as a political figure. They love the us against them. They love the idea that Donald Trump is this person who's, again, smashing all of these norms and rewriting the playbook and doesn't play by your politically correct rules, and says it how it is. And how it is that we're being invaded by immigrants who need to be dealt with, among many other things. And so that is his political coalition, right? That is his electorate, is to get those two groups to show up.
And is that because they think that those things are not being addressed and that they think that they've been unfairly smeared as racist themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely speaks to this idea that people of color and women and religious minorities have all made these tremendous strides in the past, you know, however many decades, to the point that sort of regular working class white folks are being left behind. That they're all being smeared as racists and, you know, as bad people. And Donald Trump, you know, gave voice to that in 2016. Senator Lindsey Graham, who's kind of become one of the president's bigger boosters, his argument for why these comments weren't racist was, you know, he said, "I really do believe that if you're a Somali refugee who likes Trump, he's not going to say go back to Somalia. A racist says go back to Somalia because you're Somali or Muslim or whatever. That's just the way he is. It's more narcissism than anything else."
The bottom line is that if you embrace his policies, it doesn't matter where you come from, he probably likes you.
So he's only racist against people who disagree with him.
Right. Essentially, that's what he's saying. But, you know, he's kind of giving away the game in that comment. I don't know that Senator Graham realizes that. I mean, you don't get to define people's Americanness or their right to be in the country, their right to run for political office, their right to criticize the country based on whether or not they back your agenda.
President Trump today declared, "I don't have a racist bone in my body," but the firestorm over his racist tweets is only growing.
There seems to be a lot of shock about Donald Trump's tweets that so many people think are racist. Should we be surprised?
No, you'd have to have not been paying attention to anything in the man's biography, anything in his resume, his CV, anything in the story that brought him to the White House to be surprised. Right, I mean, this goes all the way back to the early 1970s when the Trump Management Company was sued on allegations that employees were directed to tell African American lease applicants that there were no open apartments.
Some of the applications were marked with a C, which we learned that it meant colored, so that the prospective tenants who had come in were noted to be colored.
It's worth saying that the Trump Organization did settle that case and didn't admit to any guilt, but there were other early incidents where Trump appeared to treat minority groups differently.
You'd have to go back to private remarks that he allegedly made about it making him sick that black people touched his money in casinos.
He went on to say, "What I want counting my money is short guys with yarmulkes on their head." So it was a pretty shocking conversation.
Reports that casino managers would clear the casino floor of black employees when Trump was coming down onto the floor. You know, the early 1990s and Trump taking out 4 full-page ads in New York newspapers calling for New York State to bring back the death penalty so that they could execute the Central Park five black and brown teenagers in New York who were wrongfully accused of a rape.
This crime happened April 19th, 1989. On May 1st, Donald Trump had already taken out the ads. It was being ran in New York City's newspapers calling for the death penalty to be reinstated. What was happening was that we were given a social death. We were being tried in the media, and they were getting ready to lynch us.
You'd have to go back to Donald Trump's emergence on the U.S. political stage as the ringmaster of the so-called birther conspiracies about Barack Obama not having been born in America.
A lot of people do not think it was an authentic certificate.
Donald, you're beginning to sound a little ridiculous. I have to tell you.
No, I think you are. Well,
and that was the moment that Donald Trump went from being sort of like a reality star and a playboy real estate magnet into someone who, you know, was on the U.S. political stage. Then he literally kicked off his presidential run with a diatribe describing Mexicans as rapists.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Shortly after that, as the sort of scandal of those comments roiled, said that, you know, he didn't think a federal judge, Judge Curiel, would be capable of giving Donald Trump a fair trial in a fraud case because of his Mexican heritage. You'd go back to his ban of people coming from Muslim countries.
To keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America.
You go back to his comments during the white nationalist moment in Charlottesville that there were good people on both sides of that.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
The two sides that Donald Trump was talking about were white supremacists on one, who carried neo-Nazi slogans under the chilling symbol of a torch-lit parade.
You will not replace us! You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
And a group of counter-protesters determined to oppose them on the other. On the 12th of August, a far-right fanatic fascinated by Hitler murdered 32-year-old anti-racist campaigner Heather Hare by ploughing his car into the protest.
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
Trump's comments, in which he suggested moral equivalence, caused fury. As the second anniversary of this deadly white nationalist rally approaches, The Guardian's Washington bureau chief, David Smith, returned to the university town.
It's almost the ground zero of Trump's racial rhetoric. The first person I met was an African-American woman called Olivia.
Do you think white supremacists are feeling bolder now than they did 5 or 10 years ago?
I'm sure they are, but I don't think they were ever silent. They've always been around. They just now feel that they have a platform and a supporter. That's the difference. They're coming out of the dark and into the light.
She talked about even her childhood. She has memories of school where she suspects her white classmates probably linked to the Ku Klux Klan.
But my classmates didn't tell me that or let me know that. And now people are boldly letting you know that they are that. So it's sad, but it's reality and it's always been there.
We know that 80% of people in Charlottesville voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. So it's not kind of Trump's natural territory. But what was the sense on the ground? Do people think that he's going to win a second term?
I met a man called Michael Dorn, who really believes Donald Trump will win re-election.
Just because there's a bunch of people who are going to support him, whether they're, you know, racist or not, or well-educated or not. Some people just go with his, like, image or bravado or whatever.
And did you speak to any people in Charlottesville who had voted for Trump in 2016? Did they agree with the direction he's going in?
just statistically, there are not that many Trump voters, but I came across a couple, and there was a man named Tyler, and a bit of a mix of liberal and conservative, and he bitterly regrets voting for Donald Trump in 2016.
Against my better instincts, I knew Trump was a liar. I knew he said he wanted to grab women by the pussy.
He did so through mainly, I think, disaffection with Hillary Clinton and feeling that anybody would be better than her.
I very much regret that vote. I don't think much good has come from it. I think Donald Trump is still a complete bold-faced liar over the dumbest things in the world. He absolutely is a race baiter. Maybe not a racist, although he is. He tweeted last week. I mean, come on. Go back to where you came from.
There was another man called Rob, works in local radio, among other things. He was completely unrepentant, and I think certainly will vote for Trump again. He felt that this whole racism issue is overblown and unfair.
One of the things that people love about this president is that they're tired of politicians who are constantly hiding who they are. And if the president feels passionate about this and this is the way he reacts to it, they're not bothered so much by it.
Given that Trump is willing, clearly, to say racist things, did 62 million people knowingly elect him in that way in 2016?
Yes, I think so. I think there was not much doubt about what people were getting with Trump. This was an election following Barack Obama, the first African-American president, were a crucial part of the Trump so-called movement, bound up also with some economic grievances. But the very Trump campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, is widely seen as code for Make America White Again, or Take America Back to what white people see as an idyllic era of the 1950s, an era, of course, also where black people were systematically discriminated against.
And there has been a big backlash to these comments that you've mentioned. Have they hurt him electorally?
These comments have not necessarily hurt him electorally. In fact, there's already been some reporting suggesting they went down very well with Republicans and potentially strengthened him. Remember, he is wildly popular with the Republican Party with an approval rating of 80 or 90%. At least the other half of America, liberals, progressive Democrats, are furious about it. So right now, Trump has an extremely low approval rating compared to other presidents. Polls show him losing a potential election against Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and others. But ultimately, nobody really knows anything about polls and politics. Worth remembering that 2016 election was so incredibly close. He lost the popular vote, won narrowly in the Electoral College, that it's pretty impossible to predict any of this. It's like spinning a coin.
And it's worth saying, isn't it, that in America, incumbents tend to stay in power, particularly when the economy is doing well. Isn't that all pointing towards a Donald Trump victory?
Yes, he has two big advantages. The last incumbent to lose the White House was George H.W. Bush in 1992, when people were very anxious about the economy, and he was up against a charismatic Bill Clinton. This time, Trump has tons of charisma on his side. He's definitely a giant TV personality, and I think that is really important in this era.
This might seem like a weird thing to say, David, but I feel from covering elections that actually often instinct comes through more than polling when you go and talk to people about what they think. And the instinct in America appears to be that Donald Trump will win. Over half of people in a poll in June said that he was going to be re-elected. What do you think is driving that instinct?
Yeah, there's an instinct Trump will win, partly through a pessimism, especially born of 2016. African Americans especially were not surprised by that result. It was kind of, hey, America is racist. Who knew? And so there's a tendency to think, well, he did it once. He can do it again.
But even if he wins next year, in the longer term, isn't this all very high risk for the Republicans, given the demographic change underway in America?
Yes, and some analysts I speak to say ultimately they are doomed. There was a Republican autopsy report after Mitt Romney's defeat by Barack Obama in 2012 that said the only way Republicans can survive is by reaching out, appealing to a much more diverse electorate. And then, of course, Trump comes along and does the exact opposite. Right now, they benefit from a kind of time machine where the electorate is about a decade behind the actual demographics of the population, and that's for all sorts of reasons due to voter suppression and the electoral college. But eventually, even the people who vote will catch up, and that will be a terrible day for Republicans' chances at the ballot box.
That was Jamiles Latte and David Smith. Do go to the website to read all their reporting on this story and the 2020 race. Coming up, rising tensions in the Gulf.
I'm Emma John, and I'm sorry. I lied to you.
It's the spin!
I said we'd be happy if England won the World Cup, but lost the Ashes. It's not true. I want it all. I know it's greedy, but positioning the urn next to the World Cup on Ben Stokes' mantelpiece would make this the ultimate summer for English cricket. So join us on the spin as we turn ourselves into emotional wrecks all over again. It couldn't be as nerve-wracking as the World Cup final. Could it?
It's the spin!
The spin is supported by NatWest.
Now, Julian Borger, The Guardian's World Affairs editor, takes a look at the standoff in the Gulf over Iran's decision to seize a British-flagged oil tanker.
On Friday, a British-flagged oil tanker, Stena Impero, was going through the Strait of Hormuz and on the way to Saudi Arabia to get a load of oil when Iranian boats came alongside it and told it to veer off course and towards Iran. A British warship was close by and told the tanker to keep going, but the Iranians landed troops on board the oil tanker from a helicopter, took over the tanker, and it was steered to the Iranian coast at Bandar Abbas. Now, Iran has made clear that this is retaliation for the British seizure on July the 4th of an Iranian tanker, which was going through the Gibraltar Strait into the Mediterranean. The UK said it was bound for Syria, which is banned under EU sanctions. Iran has denied this, and as this case of the Grace One dragged on and the Gibraltar Authority said no, they were going to keep it for another month, it was clear that the Iranians made the decision to step up things at their end and made this very risky gambit in the Strait of Hormuz. It's clear that the US was involved in the seizure of the Grace One all the way along the line. According to the Spanish press, the Grace One was being tracked by satellite, which is entirely to be expected as the main focus of US policy on Iran is now to sort of turn off the taps when it comes to oil exports. So oil, Iranian oil exports are being watched. And what seems to have happened is that the US tipped off the Spanish first, and the Spanish said, "We're too late for us to intervene." So the US contacted the British based at Gibraltar, and the British did take that decision to intervene. Despite this, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, made it clear on Monday that it was really up to the British to look after their own ships, that it wasn't a US responsibility. Now, technically, this is true. You're supposed to look after the ships under your flag, but there is supposed to be an international task force there, and this looks from the US sending a message to the UK, that because the UK isn't fully signed on to its campaign of maximum pressure on Iran, then the US is not going to come rushing to its aid when it gets in trouble with Iran. From the UK's point of view, this couldn't have happened at a worse time, because you have a new prime minister, expected to be Boris Johnson, due to take office this week, and he will be immediately faced with a major international crisis, where he already obviously has a crisis on his hands in the shape of Brexit. He will straight off have to confront what Britain's stance should be towards Iran, what Britain's relationship should be like with the US on this very contentious issue of the nuclear deal and the US campaign of maximum pressure. As Foreign Secretary, Johnson was a staunch supporter of the nuclear deal, even to the point of being defiant to the US on this. But it's very different being a prime minister, especially prime minister of a country that is in crisis, largely because of Brexit, that he supports. So he's in a very difficult position, because the logic of Brexit is that the UK would become closer to the US.
That was Julian Borger, and if you didn't hear him on our previous Today in Focus episode, Is John Bolton Trying to Drive Trump to War with Iran? Then do have a listen. That's all for today. My thanks to Jamiles Latte, David Smith and Julian Borger. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Rosie Gillett. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.